Hello and welcome to the Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week, the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance take you beyond the numbers and hype, right to the heart of the big issues of the day. Today, on the 21st of March, we're marking the United Nations International Day of Forests and exploring a UBS paper entitled Seeds of Change, also published today, that explores how to achieve UN Sustainable Development Goal number 15, Life on Land. The report unpacks the challenge presented to the planet by a reduction in forest cover, habitats, and diversity, and considers how philanthropists can help to effect positive change and make an enduring difference. We'll be meeting the head of UBS in Society, and also two UBS Global Visionaries and UBS Optimus Foundation grantees who've already demonstrated how to have exactly that sort of impact. Our planet and its inhabitants are under threat. In the past 50 years, the world's human population has doubled, and we're using the Earth's resources at an unsustainable rate. Natural habitats are being destroyed. Wildlife populations have fallen by 60%. Many species are endangered or already extinct. And if we don't reverse climate change, mankind could also join that list. Global biodiversity funding is estimated to be up to $91 billion US dollars annually. It sounds a lot, but to reverse biodiversity's decline by 2030, research suggests the world needs to spend up to 10 times as much for the next 10 years. Public sector funding is not likely to increase soon, so it's up to all of us to act, whether as philanthropists, investors, business leaders, or individuals. Let's hear then from the first of our special guests today for more on this. Phyllis Kurlander-Costanza is head of UBS in Society and also the CEO of the UBS Optimus Foundation. Phyllis, thank you so much for joining us on the programme. Why is UBS releasing the Seeds of Change guide? Why now? Set the scene for us a little, if you will.
We are about a year into this pandemic, and I'm working from my New York City apartment where I, like billions of other people around the world, are going stir crazy. And I think that's a pretty good scene setter for biodiversity lost and the impact of what we're doing around biodiversity. And it's not just that we're cutting down forests and our wildlife is now moving into places where people are, where they've never been before, but wildlife populations have fallen by 60%. And half of the world's primary forests have been cut down in the past 75 years. And our population in the last 50 years has doubled. I have kids now who are 21 and 23. And I remember reading them books about, you know, saying, oh, the population is now 6 billion. And I was going through these books trying to purge things. That's something that a lot of us are doing now. And I was looking at these books thinking, wow, even just in that time, our population has gone up to more than 8 billion. And so it's not whether we take action on this issue, but how can we do it? And as the world's largest global wealth manager, our clients care about this. And we want to be a catalyst for our clients to help them drive positive change. And we've got a long and successful track record in doing that. And right now, biodiversity is top of mind and our clients care about it. You know, you can't pick up a newspaper without seeing an article about this issue. And it's something that we need to take action on and now.
Phyllis, and UBS is suggesting that the private sector and individuals step in here rather than leaving it to governments. The investment we all need to make is so great, I guess, that we just can't afford to wait around.
Yeah, I think you're right. We can't wait for government to take action. And let's look at the capital markets. What are there? Some $300 trillion invested in the capital markets. And that is our lever for change. And even though right now global biodiversity funding is estimated to be up to about $90 billion each year, it's not enough. We need at least 10 times that much to address this problem over the next 10 years. And we're not going to get there with philanthropy alone. We really need to tap in to the capital markets. And, you know, we see the consequences, like I said before, with COVID as the primary consequence of this. And if we look at the vehicles we have to drive capital, I mentioned philanthropy, and that is a great tool if it's used to leverage larger investments and focus on fundamental systemic change rather than putting band-aids on the symptoms. Private investment is really where we're going to dramatically lift the volume of financing far beyond what philanthropy can do alone. And then there's also blended finance options, which is a combination of the two and helps to bridge the gap between things that aren't quite investable yet. So for instance, we have one organization we're working with called the Africa Forest Carbon Catalyst. And we're finding that to help them in supporting sustainable and profitable forest-related enterprises and projects, if we put in some philanthropic capital up front, it enables them to prepare for more investable opportunities later. And that's a combination of both the philanthropic and the investment capital at work.
Yeah, there's really some really exciting developments in that space. And it's good you mentioned that one particular Optimus grantee, Phyllis. And we're going to speak to another, Nicole Roycroft from Canopy, which I believe is another Optimus grantee a bit later in the programme. So good to sort of point us in that direction. I'm sure that the position you described, the words you're using, Phyllis, will really make an impact with people. And I guess that's the point of continuing to sort of bang this particular drum. If there are people out there, particularly, you know, higher net worth individuals, maybe people with significant philanthropic resources, what are some of your tips and advisories then for how those people with that philanthropic potential and with an interest in this space, what are some good tips to get them to support this particular area, this particular sort of UNSDG target?
Well, I think it's not as difficult as it seems. So number one, get informed. And that's why we wrote this guide to help clients and others understand what the challenges are. And so I would recommend that everybody read Seeds of Change. And it's a really clear guide for describing the problem and potential solutions for it. And then the second one, we always encourage philanthropists or investors to collaborate, to work together, because only if they work together will they be able to build on individual strengths. And it's also a great way for them to learn. And we put together our own collaborations, and we have one around climate change right now, where we bring together clients from around the world to work together to solve some really specific, tangible problems. And this is one of them. And then, you know, at the risk of sounding like a Nike ad, just do it. Get started, because we need the money flowing into this now. We cannot wait. This is a critical issue that continues to worsen. And so, you know, we recommend that people get their money out there and have it start working for you.
I guess one question that people must bounce back to you when you're having this conversation with investors, clients, and just other interested parties is, all well and good, and we understand how that makes sense, but what about, you know, putting your own house in order, if you like, in terms of what UBS as a firm does and is aiming to do to support improvements in biodiversity, to support life on land? Can you talk to us a little bit about the corporate picture as well?
So this is another area where we want to be ahead of regulators on this issue. And, you know, I expect at some point, perhaps this will be regulated. But right now, we're really committed to acting responsibly. And we have identified areas in which we will not engage. And those are areas that endanger animal species and also contribute to deforestation and the impacts. And we have really clear standards for controversial activities. And this is included in our environmental and social risk policy framework. And we not only take into account issues like deforestation and forest degradation, but also things like fisheries, which has a big impact on marine species. And also, after focusing on social issues for the past two decades, we recently launched a new UBS Optimus Foundation environmental portfolio. And this is really set to be a pivotal year for nature and climate. And philanthropy can play a really catalytic role in this space. So we are encouraging our clients who are interested in climate change to fund things around biodiversity. And we have hired also an expert in this space to help guide our clients. And then we also support a range of global visionaries. And Shara and Nicole are two of them. And they're really thought leaders in this space and working hard to improve our environment. And we encourage our clients to meet them and to get inspired by them and to just do it, as I said before, take action.
Phyllis Curlander-Costanza. Well, let's follow Phyllis's suggestion and meet those two inspirational characters next. Shara Tikiu is co-founder and CEO of C16 Biosciences. Shara is also a UBS Global Visionary. Shara and C16's work is in developing new, cleaner ways of producing palm oil using biomanufacturing in a bid to address the land-intensive processes involved in its production and to reduce the massive contribution that the industry makes to climate change. Shara, thanks for being with us. Your business is not so much about pivoting behaviour as it is about being profoundly disruptive, with this goal, of course, of saving forests. Tell us a little bit about what C16 Biosciences does, how it works.
So C16 Biosciences combines processes from nature and biotechnology to produce clean oils and derivatives of oils that can replace palm oil and other vegetable oils. So you're right. It really is about changing the way that we produce certain ingredients in our consumer supply chains today.
And I think probably our listeners may well be familiar with some of the problems, particularly that the production of palm oil causes. But I think it's no bad time, you know, talking on Forest Day itself, to go back over that. Can you paint us a bit of a picture, Shara, about exactly how serious the situation is? Tell us why the stakes are so high.
Sure. So first of all, palm oil is ubiquitous. It's found in nearly 50% of products on supermarket shelves, and it's in everything from soaps and shampoos to makeup and packaged foods. And it's a good oil because it has a sort of unique structure that allows it to perform so well across all of those categories. But the problem with palm oil and more broadly with vegetable oils is the way that it's produced. So just to take a step back, I started working on this company and really learning about the palm oil problem firsthand about 8 years ago in Singapore. So today, you know, it's March 2021 and we're all wearing masks because there's a virulent global pandemic. But in 2013, I flew to Singapore and was mandated to wear a mask because of deforestation. Tropical deforestation linked to agriculture emits about 1.5 billion tons of carbon dioxide each year. And deforestation from vegetable oils, and particularly palm oil, compose a huge part of that. So I mentioned earlier that palm oil is in 50% of products on supermarket shelves already. But I think one of the really sort of important issues is that as the world population grows to nearly 10 billion people by 2050, demand for vegetable oils is expected to grow about 300%. We don't have a choice. We have to solve this problem. Agriculture alone cannot solve this problem. And so we have to think really differently. And that's what we're trying to do at C16.
If we go back to what you said before, the scale of the challenge you're trying to get stuck into is absolutely vast, almost, I would say, forbiddingly, prohibitively vast. And yet, companies like yours are making inroads. Tell us a bit about what progress looks like. What are the day-to-day mechanics of what you and your colleagues are doing?
Sure. So what we do, just to start, and then I'll sort of explain why I think that matters, we use biomanufacturing to produce safe and sustainable palm and vegetable oil alternatives. So essentially what that means is we use microorganisms found in nature and we ferment them. Fermentation is a technology that's been used in our food systems for decades to make things like cheese and wine and beer and even medicines like insulin. But we use fermentation to produce an oil which looks and functions just like palm oil and its derivatives, which are found throughout consumer products. So biomanufacturing is essentially the combination of using nature, processes in nature, and the latest advances in biotechnology, if you will, to change the way that we make products and to make them in ways that align more closely with the values that consumers have and the values that they want in their products. So it's essentially about creating no compromise products where I can have a product that is great for me. It performs well for me. I am safe consuming or using it, but is also great for the planet. So it is a massive problem, as you point out. And I think the good news is that brands that use palm oil in their products and consumers that buy the products really want this. I mentioned that I had first learned about the palm oil problem when I was in Singapore 8 years ago, but the industry has been rallying for over 10 years at this point to stop using conflict palm oil, which is oil produced with deforestation. And at this point, over 250 companies and 9 countries have made public commitments to stop using this conflict palm oil, but essentially they've failed because they have no viable alternatives. Agriculture alone cannot solve this problem. And that's why we believe that biomanufacturing sort of has to play a role in solving this problem, because we can't do it with agriculture alone. So the first step is really where me and my team have been spending our time, is demonstrating that there is a viable alternative, that we can use this new process of biomanufacturing to make an oil which can replace the function of palm oil. And from there, we need to get to higher volumes and lower unit cost as quickly as possible.
Is there any alternative other than, as you say, finding that scalability and driving the cost down? And I wonder, does that process necessarily involve further buy-in from other stakeholders, whether they're other palm oil producers or the countries that rely most significantly as a proportion of GDP for the production and export of palm oil? Or is it more about other stakeholders, other nations or supranational organizations, to make sure they put their money, if you like, where their mouth is?
You know, I mean, I believe that change gets pushed uphill. So I really believe that this change will get pushed uphill by consumers who demand the ability to buy products in which they don't have to compromise on sustainability. When given the choice, no consumer wants to go to the store and pick up a product that burns forest versus one that doesn't burn forest. And we're starting to see pressure, and we've seen pressure from consumers around other sustainability issues with clean meat and animal products, and even in this space when we were using animal fats historically. And I believe they're really going to be the ones that change this. So really, anybody who sort of is linked to that end consumer will be touched by this. I think one other perspective here is that palm oil is a true market failure, because even though we've seen firsthand the extent of impact that palm oil production has had on climate change and on biodiversity and on forest, brands continue to buy it and put it in their packages because it's artificially cheap, because there's no price on carbon, and because certain groups continue to be incentivized to burn forest because the penalty is not there and there's no better alternative. So another part of what we have to do, in addition to demonstrating that there is a better way to make palm oil and other vegetable oils that looks quite different, the other thing we have to do is also convince people who may currently be engaged in burning forest that there is a better alternative to that. So this is really, I think, as is true with most, if not all, market failures, this is really about a systems change approach. And it's not just about the technology, but it's thinking about the technology as one piece of it, but also how do we think about changing incentives for people and creating better jobs? I mean, I think one of the realities that we have to face is palm oil production does create jobs today, but there's been actually some excellent investigative reporting in the last 6 months that uncovers some of the ugly truths about what those jobs look like, including child labor, debt bondage, and in fact, much worse. One of our goals is to think about not only how do we make better palm oil alternatives, but also how can we create better jobs in that value chain, instead of sort of driving everything down to the lowest cost, including the cost of human labor.
If you could say to people, look, just one thing, if you just change one behavior, or if you ask yourself a different question this day, because it's the day that marks this focus on the sustainable development goal number 15 about land and about forests, what would you sort of invite people to consider if they're reflecting upon this as a result of listening to this program?
Yeah, I mean, I mentioned before that I believe consumers actually have tremendous power in driving change, and they really are the ones driving that change for this problem uphill to brands and even the plantations today. So part of my job is to make sure that we can create those better alternatives. And I've got a great team working with me to do that. And in the future, I believe that we'll have radically different agriculture supply chains, that they'll be safe, sustainable, traceable, and efficient. And only by having these radically different agricultural supply chains can we enable the ongoing protection of forest. So part of our job and our team's job is really to sort of rally through the ability of this biomanufacturing to play a huge role in these supply chains. But I think consumers are really the ones that enable that. And what we can or can't do with technology doesn't matter if consumers don't want it. And so I think maybe the sort of call to action would be, what are the products which don't, you know, ask yourself, what are the products that don't align with my values, where I do have to make compromises? And brands listen. They listen. They listen to letters. They listen to shareholder resolutions. They listen to angry consumers on the internet, on Twitter. So I think consumers have never had a more powerful voice. And if protection of forest is something that we believe in, we should use our voices to speak very, very loudly and send those signals across supply chains.
Shara Tiku, thank you for being with us. Nicole Rycroft is the founder and executive director of Canopy. An award-winning conservationist, Nicole and non-profit Canopy have protected 25 million acres of forests to date. Canopy works with businesses to ensure they're not sourcing their paper, packaging, or textiles from endangered forests. They've partnered with more than 750 publishers, printers, and fashion brands, from Penguin Random House to The Guardian, and from H&M to Zara. Canopy is a UBS Optimus grantee. Nicole Rycroft, thanks for joining us. You specifically work to save forests. I reckon we all think we understand this imperative, but do remind us precisely why this matters and matters so profoundly.
Our relationship with forests starts with the very moment that we draw our first breath. Like, forests are foundational to life on Earth. They make the air that we breathe. They make the and draw precipitation across continents. They protect us from pandemics like COVID and Ebola. And keeping carbon-rich, intact forest standing is the cheapest and fastest way for us to stabilize our climate. I think we're all aware that humanity is grappling with two planetary crises, the climate crisis and the precipitous decline in biodiversity. And forests represent 30% of the climate solution, and they provide habitat for 80% of the terrestrial biodiversity that we share this planet with. And scientists are really clear that conserving half of the world's forest by 2030 is critical to mitigating both of those problems. And at the moment, we have less than 20% of the world's original large tracts of forest still intact.
How does one address a problem on that scale then, Nicole? Canopy's a non-profit, but you work with businesses. Tell us about the mechanics, if you like, of engaging with the challenge.
Well, I think to start off, it can seem overwhelming. Anybody who's read an environmental journal or a scientific journal or even the newspaper is likely to reach for a glass of wine whenever they get to the environmental stories section, right? Like, there's a lot of sobering news. But I think that the key is to really stay focused on what we can do. You know, where do we need to head? And, you know, definitely we've got some big changes to make, but what can we do and what's within our power? And so that's where Canopy really focuses. We are a solutions-driven NGO. We work to protect the world's forests and species and climate and help advance frontline community rights. And we do it by harnessing the power of the marketplace, as you just said, Tom, and really focusing on how can we work together to transform unsustainable supply chains that are currently driving forest degradation and deforestation. Supply chains like the viscose or rayon supply chain or the paper-based packaging supply chain. And so what we do is we approach companies, and we currently work with more than 750 large corporate consumers of paper and packaging and wood-based fabrics. Companies like H&M and Zara and Penguin Random House, and we support them to develop cutting edge environmental policies to make sure that the paper and the packaging and the fabrics that they're using isn't being sourced from the world's high carbon, high biodiversity value forest, that we work together to help kickstart the transition to conservate a circular economy, and that we advance forest conservation. And then we work with them to implement those policies over the years and to shift their suppliers' practices on the ground. Because our model of change is based on the simple business adage that the customer is always right. And, you know, the more money they spend, the more influence they have. And so when companies like H&M or Levi's or Penguin Random House, when they all start prioritizing environmental criteria, it sends a very clear message through the supply chain and creates the incentives that are necessary for logging companies and for governments to change business as usual practice. And I think a quick example of that would be our work in the fashion industry. 7 years ago, many brands and retailers were actually completely unaware that much of their rayon and viscose clothing was originating from the world's high carbon, high biodiversity value forests. If we fast forward to today, we've seen phenomenal change. Right? There are 320 brands that have formal canopy style policies to not source from ancient and endangered forests and to help stimulate the production of fabrics that are made from circular economy sources. Companies like Stella McCartney and H&M, as a result of the leadership from brands, viscose producers that represent 90% of global viscose production now have similar policies in place, and 52% of global viscose supply is now actually verified at low risk of coming from high carbon and species-rich forests. And so that's more than half of the global supply chain that's shifted in 6 years. And it's exactly the pace and scale of change that's needed if we're going to hit the climate and biodiversity targets that we have ahead of us.
You work with the support and partnership, I guess, with UBS and the Optimus Foundation. Given the scale of the challenge, as you've outlined it already, Nicole, how fundamental are collaborations like that? What does that mean in real terms for you and your team? Presumably, that is, well, I guess it's as important a strand as any other, right?
Yeah, it's a game changer for us for sure. I mean, our observation is that governments have been very slow to take bold action on climate change and biodiversity loss, and that, you know, business executives are some of the most powerful advocates that there are for the environment today. Our work with UBS, I feel very fortunate to be working with them on a number of levels. Firstly, I'm part of their Global Visionaries program, which is a remarkable program that supports the work of leading social entrepreneurs globally. And being part of that program means that you have access to the smarts and experience of the UBS team and many within the UBS network to help you refine and hone your strategy and with introductions. And then, of course, I feel very lucky that Canopy is one of the Optimus Foundation's first environmental grantees. So although Canopy works extensively with businesses, we don't enter into a financial relationship with any of them. It maintains the integrity and the power balance in our work. And so our work is reliant on and driven by philanthropic support. And so the support of the Optimus Foundation is enabling us to scale our work up to the next level of impact. So we've taken the successful work that we've done in the fashion industry and are now working to transform the packaging supply chain, which is massive and has an incredibly damaging impact on the world's forests.
If people reflect, Nicole, on this day, a forest day, if you could encourage them to, I don't know, think about one thing in a different way or do something differently because of the day that it is, what would that one thing look like? I'm mindful of the idea of, you know, the longest journey starting with a single step. We can all make a difference. You've said that already. So what should people do if they do just one thing differently today?
Well, I think connecting with a forest, go for a walk in a forest, breathe in the oxygen. Science has been quite remarkable in recent years that's shown that, you know, trees talk to each other. These are mutually supportive community that is in a forest. And so I think, you know, forests make us healthier, They reduce our stress. And so we work to protect the things that we love and feel connected to. So one easy thing that'll feel really good is to just go for a walk in a forest.
That might just be the best call to action we've heard all year. Just a final thought, perhaps, from you, Nicole, on whether you retain an optimism broadly about the future, or perhaps about our collective capacity to shape that future in a more positive way.
I think there's really good cause to be optimistic. You know, COVID-19 has really sharpened the focus on how important it is to accelerate sustainability efforts. COVID has underscored the importance of the role that forests play in protecting and buffering us against diseases and pandemics. 75% of new diseases are crossing the barrier between animals and humans. And as we degrade intact forest landscapes, we're unleashing these pathogens to which we have no resistance. And there's a recognition that to be vibrant businesses in 15 years' time, that we need to accelerate the transition to a circular economy and away from these exploitive practices that have been up until now. And so I think COVID has actually created a very dynamic reset moment within the business community around building more sustainable and just supply chains, which I find really encouraging and exciting. And I think COVID's also shown us that we can change dramatically in days or weeks, not decades, as previously put forth. And so I feel excited that, you know, now it's up to us to make it a reality. So I think that's the silver lining of a really big dark cloud of COVID.
So great to have these often hard to find silver linings illuminated for us by all our great guests today. And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Bulletin with UBS here on Monocle 24. Thanks again to Phyllis Kurlander-Costanza, Shera Tiku and Nicole Rycroft. Find out more information and download the Seeds of Change report at ubs.com/land. And to learn more about Nicole's work, you can head to canopyplanet.org. And to read about Shera and her colleagues, head for c16bio.com. And as ever, you can listen again and find out more about this programme at monocle.com or via your preferred podcast platform. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.